either. I looked at Stephen in alarm. How old are you? I asked.
13, he said.
He dropped his voice to a whisper.
I didn't really try to join. I just told him I did, so he wouldn't be disappointed in me. It's nearly a full-time job taking care of him. Who does he think would queue for the groceries if I had to go off and drill?
The local defence drilled with broomsticks because they didn't have rifles. Stephen said the colonel had donated his guns from when he fought the Boer War. They were 50 years old and full of rust.
Useless, Stephen said, but it made him feel better.
We had to queue for groceries every day now. Meat was on ration, and a lot of other things were hard to find. Onions were so scarce, they might as well have been solid gold. No one had realized that all England's onions were imported until they couldn't be imported anymore, and onions took a long time to grow from seed. In the middle of May, Hitler invaded France. The British Army had over 370,000 soldiers stationed there. They fought, and the French fought, but the Germans pushed them back and back. Then came June and Dunkirk. Later, people called it a miracle, but in our village, it felt like a disaster. Chapter 36. We woke to a vicious pounding on the door. Jamie clutched me.
Invasion, he whispered.
My heart thumped in my ears. Should we hide? I was ready to push Jamie under the bed when I heard Lady Thornton yell from downstairs.
Susan, get up! We need you! We need everyone!
While Susan flung on her WVS uniform, I clambered down the stairs. Lady Thornton stood in the open doorway, breathing hard, as though she'd been running, even though her automobile was waiting in the drive.
"What's happened?" I asked.
"A ship just docked in the village," Lady Thornton said, "full of soldiers from Dunkirk, and they were strafed on their way across the channel."
She yelled up the stairs.
"Susan!
Coming!" Susan hustled down, stuffing her hair beneath her WVS cap. She paused in the doorway and put her hand on my cheek. "You'll be okay?" she asked. "Both of you?"
"Yes," I said.
I put my arm around Jamie, and we watched Lady Thornton reverse her car in a whirl of dust.
"It's not an invasion," I said.
Jamie looked up at me.
"Strafed," he said.
"Strafed meant shot at from above by an airplane." I took a deep breath.
"Yes," I said.
We'd listened with dread to the radio the night before. The British Army had retreated so far that it was now trapped against the ocean near a French port called Dunkirk. The water was so shallow near the beach there that the Royal Navy, trying to rescue the soldiers, couldn't bring big ships close. The man on the radio had asked anyone with a small boat, one that could go close to shore, to loan it to the Navy for getting the men away. I'd seen our village's fishing boats. They could maybe carry a dozen men. I tried to imagine 370,000 men climbing onto boats a dozen at a time. It couldn't happen. There would never be enough boats. If the Germans were strafing them, they would all die.
"I'll make breakfast," I said, putting on a cheerful face for Jamie's sake.
"I'm not hungry," he said.
"I'll make sausages."
This brought a smile.
The sausages tasted odd.
War sausages, mostly oatmeal, I thought, but didn't say. I wondered what sort of meat was actually in them. We did the dishes and got dressed. We could hear planes taking off from the airfield, one after another. Dozens of planes. We went outside to watch them. They flew out toward the ocean and didn't come back.
"I want to go talk to the pilots," Jamie said.
"Not today," I told him. "They're busy."
he nodded. "They're strafing the Germans."
We stood watching the planes for a little while.
I itched to be useful, like Susan. I knew I could do something.
Jamie looked at me piteously.
"We can't just stay here," he said.
"No." Suddenly I knew what we could do. "You're going to go to Fred's," I said. "You'll help him in my place. I'm going to the village." Jamie started to protest, but I cut him off.
"I'm a junior WVS member," I said, making it up on the spot. "Lady Thornton expects me to do my duty like a soldier. I expect you to do yours."
Jamie's eyes widened. He nodded.
"And you'll stay with Fred until Susan or I come for you," I said. "He's to feed you, and if we don't come tonight, you're to sleep there. Tell him I said so."
Jamie nodded.
"Can I take butter?"
"Of course." He rode butter around the field often enough. I helped him saddle and bridle the pony. After that, I put on my sky blue dress. I plaited my own hair. I stuffed a pillowcase full of the cloth scraps Susan was supposed to be sewing into bandages. And I took my crutches and set off for town. I saw the newsreels later. They didn't upset me, not when I'd already helped Dunkirk soldiers firsthand. But those newsreels showed a lie. In them, the soldiers evacuating Dunkirk looked tired but happy. Under their tin hats, their faces were dirty, but their eyes shone bright. They grinned and waved and gave thumbs up to the camera. Stalwart British fighters, heroic and grateful to be home. Maybe there were soldiers like that somewhere. The ones in our village were shot, dead, or dying. Others were sick from the long, terrible retreat, the days without food or water. The men on that first ship who could walk had carried their severely injured comrades into the town hall, the place where I'd stood on evacuation day, waiting for someone to choose me. When I got to town, I saw a woman in a WVS uniform go inside the hall. I followed, pushing open the door. I gagged. The smell of blood hung across the room like a heavy iron fog. But worse than that, people don't tell you. They don't write about it, and they don't put it in the newsreels. When men are horribly injured, they lose control of their bowels. They mess themselves the way babies do. The stench made my eyes water and my stomach churn. The whole room was filled with wounded men on stretchers. I saw Dr. Graham working among army medics and the WVS. I saw Lady Thornton, her face streaked with blood. I saw Susan, who looked up and saw me.
"Get out of here," she barked.
Already I could see what some of the women were doing, peeling away the soldiers' pants and cleaning their naked backsides. They wouldn't want me helping with that. I nodded to Susan and slipped back outside. The street was full of less injured men. Townspeople directed them into the pub, the library, any building with open space. Men stumbled, collapsed, cried.
"Miss," said one, looking up at me. He sat on the curb with a blood-soaked leg held stiff in front of him. "Water?"
I went into the pub. It was full of soldiers and people from the village. If anyone noticed me, they didn't care. I tossed my crutches and pillowcase behind the bar, found a pitcher, and filled it, grabbed a mug, limped to the street, and gave the water to the soldier. He drank until the pitcher was empty. I went back and forth, carrying water. Eventually, the publican's daughter, who seemed about my age, came out with a heavy bucket.
"You stand here with the mug," she said. "I'll bring buckets back and forth."
Soldiers clustered around me, reeking, stinking, filthy, their uniforms crusted with sweat and blood. They drank and drank. Cracked lips, haunted eyes. another bucket of water, and another. The publican's daughter brought more mugs, which I dipped into the buckets and passed around. When the flow of men who could still walk ceased, I later learned that if they could, they went on to the train station, and then to an army base north of us. I went into the pub and tried to help the soldiers there. It was the same with them as in the hall. Blood, filth, exhaustion. Daisy, that was the publican's daughter's name, and I went down the rows giving out drinks, water first, and eventually tea. Back and forth down the rows. It seemed impossible that all these men could come from one ship, even if it had been a big ship. When I said so to Daisy, another villager cut in. "We're on the third or fourth ship by now. They're unloading wherever they can dock and going back for more." Sometime after dark, Daisy's mother insisted we rest in the kitchen. She sat us at a long table and pushed plates of food in front of us. "Eat," she commanded. Daisy sat unmoving. I was trying to will myself to pick up a fork when I saw something splash onto Daisy's plate. I looked up. Tears streamed down Daisy's face. "None of that," Daisy's mother said. "Won't help any."
"But they're dying," Daisy said.
"No, they're not. They look awful, but men can look much worse and still live. You'd be surprised. Eat and rest, or I'll send you both to bed."
We ate.
"You've ruined your dress," Daisy said.
I looked down. My sky-blue dress was covered with dark smudges and smears of grime.
"It's my favourite," I said.
Daisy nodded.
"It's pretty."
When we'd rested, we went back out and made another round of tea. One soldier looked up at me, his eyes very bright.
"Miss," he said, "could you do me a favour and write a letter for me? My hands feel a little numb."
"Daisy will," I said. My handwriting was still so slow and clumsy. I went to fetch Daisy and some paper and a pen. We came back and the man's eyes were closed.
He was dead. He died. Right there on the floor of the pub. He didn't even look wounded. He wasn't bleeding.
One of the other soldiers undid his tunic, searching for a heartbeat, and there wasn't any blood at all. But he was dead. The soldiers found a blanket and pulled it over his head.
I couldn't breathe. Dead, when he'd just been talking to me. Dead, when he'd wanted to write a letter.
A wave of grief washed over me. I started to go away in my head, to somewhere safe, to Butter or Jamie or wherever. But Daisy grabbed my hand and squeezed it hard, and I came back.
"It's really a war now," Daisy whispered.
I nodded. One of the soldiers called for tea. Daisy and I brought it to him. Most of the ships that docked at our village, the week of the Dunkirk evacuations, weren't as bad off as the first few, but all of them contained at least some badly injured men. The ships arrived at all hours. We went from crisis to crisis. The hall never emptied. The Spitfires from our airfield took off and landed in waves, constantly, day and night, flying out to protect the troop ships as much as possible. Meanwhile, the entire village fed and tended the soldiers. Before midnight on that first day, Susan found me at the pub. Daisy's mother told her what we'd been doing. Reluctantly, Susan allowed me to stay in the village. Daisy's mother said I could sleep at the pub, with them. The WVS was sleeping in shifts in their headquarters down the street.
"You're a little girl," Susan said. "You shouldn't have to see all this." "I'm old enough. I'm helping."
I wanted to tell her about the dead soldier,
but I was afraid she'd make me leave. She gave me a long look.
Yes, she said, you are.
The next morning, Susan used the pub's telephone to call Lady Thornton's house and speak to Fred and Jamie. And then we carried on. Whenever Daisy or I grew too exhausted to continue, we crept back to the kitchen and slept on the bench by the door. When we woke, we went back to work. Everyone did. It was lucky Jamie was safe with Fred. Lucky we'd put Bovril outside, where he could hunt. Susan and I stayed with the soldiers. It was our turn to fight the war. In the end, 330,000 British soldiers were saved. Winston Churchill called it England's finest hour. It was hard, listening to him on the radio, safely home with Jamie once again, to think that there had been anything fine about the shiploads of desperate and dying men. But at the same time, I felt different. There was a before Dunkirk version of me, and an after Dunkirk version. The after Dunkirk version was stronger, less afraid. It had been awful, but I hadn't quit. I had persisted. In battle, I had won.
Chapter 37.
Several days later, when Susan and I went into the village, I stopped at the pub to say hello to Daisy.
"Oh, dearie," said her mother, pulling me against her large bosom and kissing the top of my head. "I've sent her away," she said. To Susan, she added, "You'd better send yours, too."
The village was evacuating its own children. Across the channel, Hitler's army waited, less than 30 miles away. He invaded the Channel Islands, Guernsey, and Jersey, which belonged to England. The Channel Islands surrendered. Kent, which was the part of England where we were, was the closest bit to the German army in France. When Hitler invaded, he would land in Kent. Susan said nothing to Daisy's mother, but later told Jamie and me not to worry. If our mother wanted us to go somewhere else, that was one thing. But until Susan heard from our mother, we were staying put. A few days later, Lady Thornton came to try to make Jamie and me go. All the other evacuees and nearly all the village children were leaving. The WVS, Lady Thornton said, would find a home for us somewhere safe.
"Their mother won't know where they are," Susan protested.
"Of course she will," Lady Thornton said. "I'll see that you get their new address, and whenever she contacts you, you can pass it on."
Susan hesitated.
"I'm not sure."
Lady Thornton's nose narrowed the way it did when she was angry.
"There will be an invasion," she said in a tightly clipped tone. "German soldiers in our streets, in our homes. War in our streets, quite possibly. The children should be as far away as we can send them. Margaret isn't coming home this summer. She's going straight to her new school."
I felt a pang of regret. I'd been expecting to see Maggie soon.
Lady Thornton said, "You must send them away."
Beneath the regret came a bigger wave of emotion, coiling up, rising in my gut. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it meant. I looked out the window and frantically tried to think of butter.
"Things worse than bombs," Susan was saying.
Lady Thornton shook her head.
"War is no time for sentiment."
"Is it sentiment?" Susan asked.
Her voice sounded far away behind the humming in my ears. Susan put a hand on my shoulder.
"Look at them," Susan said. "Look at Ada. If she gets put with the wrong person, she'll go right back to where she was."
I shook my head, struggling to stay with them, to hear them above my increasing panic. But Lady Thornton didn't reply. When I risked a glance at her, she was staring at Susan with an expression I couldn't read.
"She isn't easy," Susan said,
but I'll fight for her. I do fight for her. Someone has to.
At last Lady Thornton spoke.
I see, she said quietly. I'm not sure you're correct, but I see what you're saying. But the boy...
No,
Susan said. Separating them would kill them both.
When Lady Thornton had left, Susan sat Jamie and me down beside her on the sofa. She said,
Listen, I am not sending you away.
She talked a long time after that. I heard nothing beyond the words, not sending you away. The wave inside me flattened out. I could breathe again.
How do you feel about it? Susan asked me.
How did I feel? I had no idea. I didn't know the words to explain.
I was choking, and now I can breathe.
Susan waited for me to say something. I still felt dizzy, overwhelmed. I swallowed.
I guess I'd rather stay here, I said.
Good, Susan said, because I'm not giving you a choice.
Susan had been right that all the green leaves and grass came back in summertime. The weather was glorious. Butter's pasture reached his knees, and the vegetables in our victory garden thrived. Fred found an old bicycle in one of the sheds at Thornton House and fixed it up for Jamie to ride. School had closed for good, since most of the children were gone, so Jamie came with me every day to help Fred. The former gardener had proved useless around horses, frightened of them and therefore inclined to smack them around. He'd been called up anyhow. Fred was alone again. Lady Thornton had sold two horses and put down three more who were past being ridden, but that still left a lot of work to do. The best pastures had been taken over for crops. The government sent land girls to take the place of the enlisted male farm workers. They moved into the old stable boys' apartments, but they only helped with the farming on the estate, not the horses.
"Horses aren't important these days," said Fred.
Jamie was finally, permanently, and completely banned from the airfield. They were too busy to have him around. Planes took off in bunches all day and all night. We could see them high in the sky, tiny specks patrolling the channel, watching, waiting for the invasion that would come. I struggled to fall asleep in the long, bright summer nights. Jamie and Bovril snored in unison, loudly. One night, when the noise grew too much to bear, I crept downstairs to the slightly darker living room. Susan sat on the sofa, her legs curled beneath her, staring into nothing. It was not the deep, sad staring from the year before.
"Can't sleep?" she asked, when she saw me.
I shook my head. Susan patted the sofa beside her. I walked across the room and stood in front of her, my good foot and the crutch tips deep in the plush rug, the toes of my bad foot barely brushing the ground.
"Everyone still thinks I should send you away," Susan said.
I nodded. Lady Thornton said so often. I went to Susan's WVS meetings sometimes to help sew, and Lady Thornton made a noise in the back of her throat every time she saw me.
"Part of me does agree," Susan continued. "I know they mean well, but I also understand now why some of the mothers from London took their evacuated children back so soon. Some things you've got to face as a family.
Hitler was in Paris. He could be in London next week."
"For the longest time," Susan went on, "I thought I was neglecting you. I didn't take care of you the way my mother took care of my brothers and me. My mother watched me all the time. She always kept me neatly dressed. She ironed my shoelaces. She would never have let you run wild the way I have. But now, when I look at you, I think I didn't do so badly. I think you wouldn't have liked being raised the way my mother raised me. What do you think, Ada?" I sat down on the sofa. I never know, I said. When I'm not thinking, everything's clear in my head. But as soon as I try to look at it, I get confused.
I leaned against the back of the sofa. I understand, Susan said. Sometimes I feel like that too.
I leaned my head against her, the tiniest bit.
She didn't move.
I leaned a little bit more. She put her arm around my shoulders, so that I was nestled against her. As I drifted into sleep, I thought I felt her lips brush the top of my head. The first air raid was worse than Christmas Eve.
Chapter 38.
It came the second week of July. It had been a hot day, so we had kept the windows wide open and the blackout down. For once, I'd fallen into a sound, dreamless sleep. Whoop whoop, whoop whoop, whoop whoop. The sirens at the airfield wailed, louder and louder. You'd have thought one was in our bedroom. Jamie jumped up, scrambling to keep hold of Bovril, who thrashed and scratched in an effort to get free. I grabbed my crutches. Susan came flying in, her dressing gown flapping. "Hurry, hurry," she said. I couldn't hurry. Going downstairs took time. My hands shook. I wouldn't be fast enough. I would be bombed. Jamie ran ahead, but Susan waited for me.
"It's all right," she said. "Don't panic."
Across the living room, out the back door. Jamie ducked into the Anderson shelter and stuffed Bovril into his basket. The cat howled. He sounded like a baby screaming in pain. I stood at the door of the shelter. I'd never yet gone inside. I hated it. It scared me. It was so much like the cabinet under the sink at home. The one with the roaches. I could never see them or stop them.
"Ada," Susan said behind me. "Move."
I couldn't do it. I couldn't go inside, not into that damp shelter that smelled exactly like the cabinet. Not into that darkness. Not into that pain. The siren wailed. Jamie shouted, "Ada, hurry!" A noise like the plane exploding. Bombs. Real bombs, here in Kent. German bombs everyone feared. Here, in the cabinet under the sink. Susan picked me up and carried me down the stairs. The smell enveloped me. I could feel the cramped cabinet, the roaches. I could hear Mam laughing while I screamed. I screamed. Another bomb. More screams. From Jamie? From me? How would I know? The memory of the cabinet seemed real, seemed to be happening right at that moment. I could see the cabinet, feel myself being shoved inside. Terror enveloped my brain. Suddenly I felt something tight around me. A blanket, a rough wool blanket. Susan wrapped me in it the way she had on Christmas Eve. Tight, round and round. "Shh," she said. "Shh." She put her arms around me and laid me on a bench and then half sat on me, squishing me between her backside and the shelter wall. "We're all here. We're safe," she said. She took Jamie onto her lap. "It's okay, Jamie. She's just frightened. It's okay." Jamie whimpered. "We're safe," Susan said. "It's okay." The pressure of the blanket soothed me. Gradually, I came back to the shelter, to Jamie and Susan. I stopped screaming. My heart didn't pound so hard. I breathed the smell of the wool blanket, wet from my tears, instead of the shelter cabinet dampness. From outside we heard another blast, farther away, and the ack-ack from the anti-aircraft guns at the airfield. "We're okay," Susan said wearily. "We're okay." When the all-clear sounded 2 hours later, Susan and I were still wide awake. Jamie had fallen asleep on Susan's lap. She carried him back to the house. I walked beside her, trailing the blanket like a cape. We lay down in the living room, too worn out to climb the stairs. Late the next morning, when we woke,
Susan said.
Ada, there will be more bombs. We will have to go into the shelter. You'd better get used to it.
I shuddered. I couldn't imagine doing that again.
What set you off? Susan asked.
Mum's cabinet. The way it smells.
I made myself go somewhere else in my head, fast, before panic overwhelmed me. Butter. I imagined riding butter.
Susan tapped my chin. We can change the smell.
She went to the market and bought aromatic herbs, rosemary, lavender, and sage. She hung them in the shelter, upside down from the edges of the benches, and their smell filled the little room even after they were crumbly and dry. I couldn't smell the dampness any more. It helped. I still panicked. Susan still always wrapped me in a blanket. But usually, I could keep from screaming, and I didn't actually see the cabinet in my head. It was still awful, but I didn't frighten Jamie. That was important, because we went into the shelter nearly every night from that first time. The Battle of Britain had begun. Hitler had figured out he couldn't land his invading army until he'd conquered the Royal Air Force. Otherwise, our planes would bomb his ships and troops while they were landing. Once he'd gotten rid of our planes, invading England would be easy. The Germans had a lot more airplanes and pilots than the British did. They had different kinds of planes, though, and their fighter planes had shorter ranges than ours. This meant that they could only reach the southeastern corner of England before they had to turn back for more fuel. They could only shoot our planes and bomb our airfields in Kent. The airfields were their main targets. Every plane they destroyed, whether in the air or parked on the ground, brought them one step closer to invasion. Every runway they destroyed gave our pilots one less place to safely land. Our airfield was hit that very first day. The bombs ripped through two storage sheds and left craters the size of small tanks in the grass runways. Fortunately, all the air crews found shelter. Once the all-clear sounded, the crews worked through the night, shoveling debris into the blast holes. By morning, planes could safely land again. It was July, and the world was green and lovely. I rode butter through fields of waving grass, up our hill, to where I could see the blue sea glittering in the bright sunlight. Wild roses grew in the hedgerows, and the air felt heavy with their scent. The breeze blew, and I could feel perfectly happy. Except that now I always watched for planes as well as spies. They hadn't come in daytime yet, but I knew they could. Susan didn't like me riding out, but she didn't want to forbid it either. Our home was so close to the airfield, I figured I was safer farther away. When I said so, she looked grim. "I should send you away," she said. It was hard enough to cope with Susan. How would I ever cope without her? What if we got sent back home? I stared at the tips of my shoes. "I can't leave Butter," I said. Susan sighed. "You survived without a pony in London." I lifted my gaze to look at her. I had survived. Maybe. Could I do it again? Back in that one room, I hadn't known all I was missing. "I know," Susan said softly. "It's why I'm keeping you here." "There's things worse than bombs," I said, remembering what I'd heard her say before.
"I think so," Susan said. "And Kent's a big place. They can't bomb every inch of it."
But she looked out the window toward the airfield, and her eyes creased with worry. Chapter 39. Nights in the shelter, night after night. It was impossible to sleep through the explosions and the gunfire. Susan had a flashlight, but flashlights needed batteries, and batteries were hard to find. Instead, she lit a candle inside a flower pot,
and by its dim light read to us. Peter Pan, A Secret Garden, The Wind in the Willows. Some were books she got from the library. Others came from her own bookshelves. On his own, Jamie was reading Swiss Family Robinson over again.
"We're like them," he said one night,
as the candlelight flickered off the shelter's tin walls.
"We're in our cave, safe and warm."
I shuddered. I had wrapped myself in a sheet, because it was too hot for a blanket. I felt warm, but not safe. I never felt safe in the shelter. "You are, though," Susan said. "You feel safer in your bedroom, but you're actually much safer in the shelter." It didn't matter how I felt. She made me go into the shelter every time the sirens wailed. Men came and removed all the signposts from the roads around the village, so that when Hitler invaded, he wouldn't know where he was. When he invaded, we were to bury our radio. Jamie had already dug a hole for it in the garden. When Hitler invaded, we were to say nothing, do nothing to help the enemy. If he invaded while I was out riding, I was to return home at once, as fast as possible, by the shortest route. I'd know it was an invasion, not an air raid, because all the church bells would ring.
"What if the Germans take butter?" I asked Susan.
"They won't," she said, but I was sure she was lying. "Bloody Huns," Fred muttered, when I went to help with chores. "They come here, I'll stab 'em with a pitchfork, I will." Fred was not happy. The riding horses, the Thorntons' fine hunters, were all out to grass, and the grass was good, but the hay fields had been turned over to wheat, and Fred didn't know how he'd feed the horses through the winter. Plus, the land girl staying in the loft annoyed him. "Work 12 hours a day, then go out dancing," he said. "Bunch of lightfoots. In my day, girls didn't act like that." I thought the land girls seemed friendly, but I knew better than to say so to Fred. You could get used to anything. After a few weeks, I didn't panic when I went into the shelter. I quit worrying about the invasion. I put Jamie up behind me on butter, and we searched the field for shrapnel, or bullets, or bombs. Once we came across an airplane shot down in a hops field. Soldiers had already surrounded it by the time we got there, and were keeping civilians away.
"A Messerschmitt," Jamie said, eyes gleaming. "Wonder where the pilot went."
The pilot had bailed out. The plane's canopy was open.
"Caught him," one of the soldiers said, overhearing. "Prisoner of war. No troubles."
On a day in early August, Susan went to a WVS meeting. Jamie was tending the garden. He loved it. And I took off on butter for my daily ride. I went to the top of the hill. I paused, the way I always did, to search the sea and sky. No airplanes, no big boats. But then I saw something in the distance, something small on the surface of the ocean. A tiny boat, a rowboat, pulling for shore. I watched it, wondering. It was headed not for the town harbour, but for one of the barbed wire sections of the beach.
Was the person lost?
Surely he knew better than to land where there could be mines. I kept watching, frowning. The man, it looked like a man, I thought, in the boat, continued to row straight for shore. Surely he could see the village from the water. Surely he knew it would be safer there. Unless, I thought, my blood running cold, he was a spy.
A spy! I couldn't believe it.
I didn't believe it. I always look for spies from the hill. It was a habit. But that didn't mean, despite the posters, despite the rumours, that I actually expected to ever see a spy. But yet, a single rowboat, so far out. Where had he come from? Did he get dropped off by a submarine? A German submarine? If he wasn't a spy,
Why was he headed toward the deserted beach?
I heard Susan's voice in my head.
Improbable, it said.
That meant not likely.
Still, it was one of the rules.
Report anything suspicious at once.
I turned butter down the face of the hill, weaving through brush and tall grass, trying to keep the little boat in sight. It disappeared from my view as I got lower, and I sped up, cantering along the road that led to the barricaded beach. I stopped butter in a copse of trees just as the beach came into view. It was low tide, and the sand stretched out wide and flat for a mile along the shoreline. Right in the center of the sand, the man stepped from his rowboat. He carried a suitcase and had a rucksack on his back. As I watched, he shoved the rowboat back into the water. The sea was quiet. The boat floated high above the gentle waves and began to drift sideways, following the shore. I swallowed hard. The man, an ordinary-looking man, at least from the distance, took something from his rucksack. He unfolded it and used whatever it was to dig a hole in the beach. He put the suitcase into the hole, covered the hole with sand, walked cautiously up the sand dunes toward the barbed wire. I couldn't see what happened next, but suddenly the man was on the other side of the fence, walking down the road toward me. I turned butter and galloped away. I could have gone to the airfield, but the police station was closer, and I knew where it was, near the school, near the shop where I'd had tea. I kept butter to a canter, even over the cobbled stone main street. I pulled him to a halt at the station, wrapped his reins around the handrail, and hurried up the steps as best as I could. I didn't have my crutches.
"I think I found a spy," I said to the first person I saw, a portly man seated behind a large wooden desk. "A spy on the beach."
The portly man turned toward me.
"Get a hold of yourself, miss," he said. "I can't understand you the way you're gabbling."
I grabbed the edge of the desk for balance. I repeated my words. The man looked me up and down, particularly down, at my bad foot in its odd homemade shoe. I fought the urge to hide it.
"How was it you saw this spy?" he asked.
He had a little smile on his face. I realized he did not believe me.
"I was out on my pony," I began.
I told the whole story. The hill, where I always kept a lookout. The little boat. The suitcase, buried in the sand.
"On your pony," the man said, nodding, his smile widening into a smirk.
"Watch a lot of newsreels, do you? Listen to the scary stories on the radio." He thought I was lying, or at best exaggerating. And now he was staring at my bad foot again. I felt a wave of heat climb up my neck.
I thought of what Susan would do. I drew myself up taller and glared at the man, and I said,
"My bad foot's a long way from my brain."
The man blinked. I said,
"I would like to speak to your commanding officer. The government asks us to report anything suspicious, and that's what I'm going to do. If you won't listen, I want to talk to someone who will."
The second police officer took me more seriously.
"We'll go in the squad car," he said, "see if we can find him."
He asked if I needed help getting to the car.
"No, thank you," I said.
I walked as straight as I could manage, even though it hurt like crazy. The officer put me in the front seat beside him, and together we started down the road. We'd hardly gotten out of town when we came across the man I'd seen, walking down the road with perfect ease. I pointed him out to the officer.
"You're sure?"
the officer asked. For a moment, I wasn't. I hadn't really gotten a close look at the man's face, but he felt like the right person. I nodded. The officer stopped his car and got out.
"Papers, please," he said.
"Really?"
said the man, in perfect English, with the accent Lady Thornton used.
"Why ever for?"
"Routine," the officer said. The man raised his eyebrow as if it were all a joke, but reached into his pocket readily enough. He pulled his identity card out of a battered leather wallet.
"I'm just on a bit of a walking holiday," he said, indicating the rucksack on his back. "My ration card's in there, if you want me to fish it out."
He could not sound more English. He could not look more English. And yet...
"Sir," I said to the officer.
He came over to the window on the passenger side and leaned in.
"I'm sorry, miss," he said, shaking his head, "but I think you've..."
I said,
"His trouser cuffs are wet, and they're full of sand."
No one went on the beaches any more. No one ever. It wasn't allowed. The officer's smile disappeared. For a moment, I thought he was angry with me. But I was wrong. The next thing I knew, the man from the beach was handcuffed and bundled into the back of the car. He protested vehemently in his perfect English voice. Back at the station, Patient Butter still stood tied to the porch rail. The officer told me to go on home. "We'll handle it from here, miss." I wanted to tell Susan, but I wasn't sure how. I put it off so that I could think about it more. We were halfway through dinner that evening when the police knocked on the door. It was my second officer and another.
"We need to speak with your daughter, ma'am."
I got up quickly. Susan looked stunned. Jamie looked delighted.
"We need you to help us locate the buried parcel," my officer said.
So I went again in a squad car, this time all the way to the beach. I showed them where I'd stood with Butter, watching, and I tried to show them where I thought the man had landed with his boat. The tide was high now, and everything looked different.
"We'll have to get the army to dig it up anyhow," the other officer said. "For all we know, the beach is mined."
He drove along the edge of the barbed wire fence. We got out near where I thought the man had gone through, and walked up and down the road until we found a footprint. The officer marked it with a piece of cloth tied to the fence, and then took me home. I paused before I got out of the car.
"Will you let me know what happens to the man?"
The officers shook their heads.
"It'll be a secret, miss."
"Will you let me know if he really is a spy?"
They looked at each other and nodded.
"But you ought to stay quiet about it," one said.
I nodded.
"Loose lips sink ships," I said.
I went in to make my explanations to Susan. She was waiting for me on the purple sofa. She listened to the whole story. Then she put her hands on either side of my face. She smiled at me, and she said,
"Oh, Ada, I am so proud."
The very next afternoon, someone knocked on our door again. It was a police officer. Not the one who had helped me, but the fat one who'd sat at his desk and thought I was making things up. "I need to apologize to your daughter, mum," he said. When he saw me, he swept off his hat and bowed. "I should have believed you," he said. "I'm sorry. A grateful nation thanks you for your service." With great ceremony, he handed me an onion. Chapter 40. The army had found the suitcase buried in the sand. It contained a radio transmitter, the sort spies used to send coded messages across the channel. The perfect Englishman really had been a spy. I became a hero. The RAF men at the airfield brought me chocolate. The WVS women pooled together a tablespoon of sugar each and gave me a whole bag. Daisy's mother from the pub hugged me whenever she saw me. And every time I went into the village, I was greeted with smiles and shouts of, "There's our little spy catcher," or "There's our good lass." It was as if I'd been born in the village.
as if I'd been born with two strong feet, as if I really was someone important, someone loved.
Jamie made me repeat the story over and over again.
"Tell me," he'd beg. "Tell me your hero story."
Maggie wrote from her school.
"Ooh, I wish I'd been with you. I might have been, you know, if I'd been home."
"I wish you had been," I wrote back.
"You wouldn't mind sharing the honors?" she replied.
I wouldn't have minded at all. It would have been easier. Hero wasn't a word I was used to hearing. The admiration was interesting, but the attention made me feel unsettled.
"Say it again," Jamie said, giggling. "Tell me what you told the first officer."
"He looked at my bad foot," I said, and I said, "My foot's a long way from my brain."
"And you were right," Jamie said.
"Yes," said Susan. "She was." Of course, the part that was frightening was that there had been an actual spy.
A real spy. Sent to make the invasion easier.
When the air raid siren started up again, it was hard not to be very afraid.
"But you caught him," Jamie said.
"I caught one spy," I said. "One." The sirens had started earlier than usual that evening, while we were still eating. We'd carried our plates to the shelter with us.
"And now he's dead," Jamie said, chewing with his mouth open. "We took him out to a field, lined him up, and pow!"
"He mimed firing a gun." I flinched. "Probably not," Susan said. "I asked." Jamie narrowed his eyes.
"What we do then?"
"Nobody will say for sure." I picked through the boiled potatoes on my plate. Susan had left the peels on, because peeling potatoes wasted food, and we weren't allowed to waste food in wartime. I didn't like the peels.
England had a lot of potatoes. We were supposed to eat them every day.
"Probably turned him," Susan said. "Made him a double agent. That means the government would force him to send false messages back to Germany with that transmitter of his."
"They'd make him tell lies," I said.
"Yes," Susan said.
Jamie scowled.
"I wouldn't do that if the Germans caught me."
"I would," I said. "If he doesn't lie, they'll shoot him. I'd lie if I had to." Now sometimes the German planes attacked in daylight. If they were far away, Jamie and I stood in the field and watched them, shielding our eyes against the sun. The planes looked like swarms of insects buzzing in circles in the sky, until one plummeted, leaving a trail of smoke. From such a distance, I couldn't tell the English planes from the German ones. But Jamie could.
"One of ours," he'd say. Or, "one of theirs."
Sometimes we could see the puff of a parachute opening as a pilot bailed out. I always hoped for that puff, even when the plane was German. Two of the pilots who had come for Christmas dinner had died. When Jamie found out, he cried himself to sleep.
I thought of their faces, how they'd laughed and played with Jamie.
Unlike Jamie, I hadn't remembered their names. I'd been too upset that day about my green dress. I understood why I'd been upset on Christmas. I'd felt overwhelmed. I really couldn't help myself.
But now, thinking back, it seemed a little silly to be unhappy about a dress when the pilots were dead. If I had it to do over, I would at least have learned their names.
England lost planes every day. Germany lost more. New planes flew into our airfield from the north of England. New pilots came straight from their training fields. They went up every day, and not all of them came back. "We had to win this battle," Susan said, "or we would lose the war." On the radio, Prime Minister Churchill said, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many
to so few.
It meant the pilots were saving us all. It meant they were the only thing keeping the Germans away.
September came. I quit attracting so much attention in the village. A week ago, British planes had attacked Berlin. The first time we'd taken the war onto German soil. Fred cackled in delight.
"We'll show 'em now."
A small piece of a damaged German plane had come down on the edge of one of Thornton's wheat fields. Fred gave it to me to take to Jamie.
"How do you know it's German?" I asked,
turning the scrap of metal over in my hands.
"I saw the bugger," Fred said. "He was heading back over the channel, trailing parts of his airplane as he went."
It was bad training to let Butter run when he was close to home, but that day I did it. I felt so happy. The sun was warm. I couldn't see planes or hear sirens, and Jamie would be so pleased to have the chunk of German plane. Butter galloped happily, his ears pricked. I'd been practicing my jumping all summer, and even though Fred hadn't given me permission yet, I knew we were ready. Instead of slowing Butter for the pasture gate, I turned him toward the stone wall and urged him forward.
He flew it. We jumped the wall at last.
Across the field, I could see Susan standing in the back garden with Jamie and an adult I didn't know. I kicked Butter on, flying down the field.
"Jamie!" I yelled. "I brought you a piece of a Messerschmitt!"
I pulled Butter up and patted his neck, laughing.
"Did you see us jump?" I asked Susan. "Did you?"
Then I recognized the woman standing beside her. "Ma'am." Chapter 41. "Ma'am." I didn't know what to think. I steadied Butter in front of the garden wall, my hands on the reins, and looked at her. She looked back at me, shading her eyes with her hand. Her expression, of mingled anger and disinterest, didn't change. "Hello," I said. She scowled.
"Who are you?"
She didn't recognize me. I dismounted Butter, landing carefully on my good left foot. I untied my crutches from the back of the saddle and swung myself forward, over the garden wall. "I'm Ada," I said. Her expression turned to outrage as she realized who I was.
"What the hell's this?" she said. "Just who do you think you are?"
Jamie was holding Mam's hand. Jamie looked so hopeful.
"Coming in on a pony," Mam said. "Like little Princess Margaret, are you now?"
"I learned to ride," I said. "I go side saddle so it doesn't hurt my..." Mam thrust a battered envelope under my nose.
"And this," she said. "What's the meaning of this, eh?"
I looked. It was one of Susan's letters. It was her handwriting on the envelope.
"Want some kind of operation, do you?" Mam said.
My heart leaped.
"They can fix my foot, the doctor said."
"Like hell they can," Mam said. "Isn't nothing going to fix that foot? First I get a letter says now I have to pay the government for taking my kids away. 19 shillings a week, and the government wants me to pay."
"No one will make you," Susan interjected.
"And then here's this. Sent to the wrong place. Just got it, I did.
And what is it but someone with the bloody cheek to be telling me what to do with my kids? And then here you are, all dressed up, sitting on a pony, nose in the air, acting for all the world like you're better than everybody."
"No, ma'am," I said.
"Like you're better than me."
"No, ma'am."
"Come on," Ma'am said. "We're going home."
Susan tried to argue. Ma'am turned on her and glared.
"You're telling me where I can take my own kids, you, a lazy slut in a fancy house."
Ma'am went on from there, telling Susan off every possible way.
I felt myself grow cold, distant, far from all of them.